Chapter 14. The Bohemia. They leave Baker Street later that night. From what they have heard of the Bohemia, it is probably better suited to the hours of darkness, and they will have more chance of finding this woman who may be able to help them, Irene Adler. The two of them stop for dinner in Chinatown. They haven't eaten since breakfast, and the food here is cheap, hot, and, though it's best not to ask too many questions about the ingredients, delicious. Holmes is fascinated by the chopsticks. Turns out that he has never used them before. One glance at the other diners, however, and he is wolfing down his noodles like a Shanghai resident. John shakes his head warily and focuses on getting his own food to his lips. Holmes is dressed for the occasion. He has borrowed what must have been one of Finn's formal suits. It has black satin lapels and a peacock blue lining, and he would cut quite a dash were it not for the fact that, like the pajamas he wore at breakfast, the suit's arms and legs are several inches too short. Nor is it helped by the white linen shirt with its oversized collar flopping down on either side of his neck. Even the Chinese waiters look at him askance. John, wearing rather more sensible tweed, is in dread of what lies ahead. What are they going to make of him at the Bohemia? After they have finished eating, they walk across the river to Waterloo Station, and from there, through a maze of dimly lit alleyways leading from Blackfriars Bridge to Leake Street. They find themselves in what feels like a secret corner of the city, surrounded by heavy, red brick archways with railway lines overhead. The Old Vic Theatre, long since converted into a psychiatric hospital, is close by. As they search for the entrance to the club, a locomotive train passes, and the moonlight is blotted out by steam and by the slow procession of a dozen clanking, rattling carriages. Suddenly the air smells of burning coke, hot metal, and engine oil. They cannot hear each other speak. Then, a moment later, the train is gone, and once again they are alone in this strange and inhospitable part of town. Ahead of them, they see two braziers burning on either side of an arched opening in the brickwork. This must surely be it. There is nothing else here apart from a few run-down shops and boarded-up houses. Victor Lynch had warned them not to look for a sign. A club dealing exclusively with the criminal underclass is unlikely to advertise itself. But as they pass between the flames and take the narrow concrete staircase that leads below street level, they wonder if this really is the place. It feels too quiet. There is no sound of any music, nobody in sight. They reach the bottom of the steps and turn a corner. A corridor stretches out ahead of them, softly lit by electric bulbs behind wire grills. They are hemmed in by bricks with the ceiling curving over their heads, as if in a catacomb. At the far end, John sees two statues, a pair of crouching jackals on either side of the sort of solid wooden door you might find outside a dungeon. So far, they are the only decoration. Holmes and Watson move towards the door. From somewhere comes a low rumbling, perhaps another train crossing the bridge. "The tokens," Holmes says very quietly. With a growing sense of unease, John takes out the circular coins, the biscuits that Lynch gave him. It is not a train. It's growling. The black marble jackals are not statues, but real living animals. Dobermans, perhaps. They have sleek flanks and sharp muzzles. The overhead lights reflect in their eyes, burning deep. The animals look lethal. "Good God," John hisses. "They're not even chained." "They clearly don't need to be. I imagine they'll only be a danger to anyone trying to enter without the requisite token." "Go on, then." John looks down at the biscuits in his hand. In case Holmes is wrong and the animals attack, he checks that his revolver is close at hand. Then he takes a deep breath and throws the biscuits, one to the left, one to the right. They arc through the air, and the dog's jaws snap in perfect synchronicity, white teeth closing like traps. The dogs chew the biscuits, and satisfied, fall perfectly still. John turns to Holmes. "So, do we just walk in?" The door clicks open automatically, and suddenly the two of them find themselves in a different world. Music, chandeliers, gold-framed mirrors and neon signs, a crowd of perhaps 200 people, smoking, talking, laughing, drinking, sitting at candlelit tables or standing at the bar which stretches out, polished wood and hundreds of glittering bottles. Waiters with long aprons and black ties, circulating with silver trays laden with champagne bottles and glasses. A small, circular stage, made of wood and framed by red velvet curtains, with six men, each of them dressed as Napoleon, with cocked hats and red and white sashes, performing a comedy dance routine. A jangling piano, snare drums, a double bass, a monkey chattering excitedly, chained to a stand, a huge snake, a boa constrictor, coiled around itself in a cage, a parrot on the branch of an artificial tree, humans and animals tangled together in this extravagant, hidden space beneath the streets of London. There is a polished, ebony reception desk in front of them, and they cannot enter the room without checking in. A neat, bald man in spectacles and suit beams at them. He is in his 60s, with the manner of a gentleman's tailor. "Good evening. I don't believe the Bohemia has had the pleasure of your company before." "No, this is our first time," Holmes replies. "Then you are very welcome. Do you have any lethal weapons you would like to check in?" Holmes glances at Watson, who reluctantly takes out his revolver and hands it to the receptionist. "Thank you, sir." The receptionist tags it and hands John a receipt. "You can collect it on your way out. Can I take your names? I'm afraid we don't accept aliases, but I can assure you that discretion is the watchword here." "Sherlock Holmes and John Watson." Holmes provides the information which the bald man enters in a ledger. "Are you visiting as individuals or are you part of a group?" "We're with the Red Circle." Holmes speaks the words with equanimity, and the receptionist likewise shows no emotion, simply making another brief note. "Can I wish you both a pleasant evening? All the bars are cash only. It goes without saying that we don't take credit. Do you have any other questions?" "Yes, we were wondering if Miss Irene Adler was in tonight." The receptionist hesitates for just half a second. "Why do you want to know?" "We'd like to speak to her." "I'm afraid I'm not at liberty to discuss Miss Adler's whereabouts."
"Could you tell her we're here?"
A thin smile. "She already knows." Irene Adler knows everything that happens in the Bohemia. She can hear every word that is spoken. 30 hidden cameras in hiding places all over the room record every movement. She recognized Sherlock Holmes the moment he walked in. His photograph and the accompanying letter from Jonathan Bloor are beside her. The COO of Biogenesis has no police record. He has never been arrested for any crime, but he is still a regular customer at the Bohemia Club. The girls do their best to avoid him. He is well known for his wandering hands. He is not only an honorary member, he is an honorary criminal. She is sitting at her makeup table in a room that is as cluttered with perfumes and cosmetics as it is with television monitors, computers, and telephones. It has been said that Irene Adler has a face that a man might die for, and she looks after it. Examining herself in the gold-framed ormolu mirror that was the gift of an admirer, who also hoped to enlist her help in a scheme to steal the last cash reserves from the Bank of England, she plucks out a tissue and wipes away the moisturizer from around her eyes, pausing briefly to examine a tiny worry line. Still there. But then, sitting at the center of a web that stretches across the entire criminal fraternity of London and beyond, she has a lot to worry about. The case of that young policewoman, for example. The police were foolish to send one of their agents into the club, especially one so gauche and inexperienced. It took her security team only a few minutes to discover Kate Nelson's real identity. And it was true that an example had to be made. But Irene had not ordered the killing, and the overzealous bodyguard who made the decision and acted on it without informing her first has now been terminated. In more than one sense. Irene Adler is not afraid of death. All her life she has grown up with it. But she is a businesswoman first and foremost, and the last thing she needs right now is a war with Scotland Yard. She has considered writing to Detective Chief Inspector Lestrade to apologise, but from what she has heard of him, he would not even read the letter, and if he did, he would not believe it. She would like to send money to the woman's family, but that will not bring her back, and worse, it will show weakness, the one thing in the world that Irene cannot afford. Regrettably, she has decided to let the matter drop, although she is aware still of a sense of regret. She reaches for the faceted glass bottle of No. 5 Chanel Grand Extrait, once one of the 10 most expensive perfumes in the world, and applies a few drops to the side of her neck. At once, she is surrounded by the aroma of 1,000 wildflowers. It chases her darker thoughts away. She should, of course, call Jonathan Bloor right now. A fight with the London police would be annoying enough, but coming up against Biogenesis would be worse. She can see Sherlock Holmes on the television screen even as she sits there. He is with a man who is dressed like a geography teacher and who is counting money onto the table in return for the 2 drinks they have ordered. It's obvious that the companion intends to leave exactly the right amount, immediate proof that he cannot actually afford to be here. Irene dismisses him. But Holmes? It's strange that he should have the same name as the CEO of Biogenesis, and she suspects it is not a coincidence. She touches a button, and the camera zooms in on the image so that she can better examine his features, his deeply intelligent eyes, a rather handsome, classical structure of his physiognomy. Bloor must want him badly to be offering such an enormous reward. Sherlock Holmes looks like an ingenue, sitting there in his ill-fitting suit, watching the cavorting of the 6 Napoleons with undisguised amusement. She finds him attractive. Could it be that Biogenesis is afraid of him? Why? Her hand has strayed to the telephone that is right in front of her, but she hesitates. She makes her decision. She will not call them out. Not yet. She gets to her feet and puts on a pair of earrings, each one made up of 28 small diamonds that hang in a cluster to her neck. A tiny smear of foundation cream hides the worry line. She takes one last look in the mirror. She is ready. She leaves the room and goes down. The 6 Napoleons have finished their act and leave the stage to tumultuous applause, which rises above the swell of conversation and bounces off the walls. The next act is a Bohemia favourite. Conjoined female twins, joined at the hip, playing a duet on Stradivarius violins, gypsy tunes from Moldova. John is surprised to see Sherlock Holmes watching them in rapture. It reminds him that the two of them have never discussed women. Is Holmes attracted to them? Could there be someone in his life who is even now searching for him? A wife? A fiancé? Or is he already married, with children? John cannot imagine Holmes with children. He's too childlike himself. As soon as Missy Hudson is safe and the secret of the Red Circle has been solved, they must pick up the threads of this other mystery. Holmes's origins have to be found. The music has a soothing quality, which is just as well, as John has been feeling increasingly uncomfortable since they were shown to their table, stuck in the bizarre, subterranean surroundings of the Bohemia. First, there are the other patrons. When he first came in, he saw them as a crowd, enjoying a night out. Examining them more closely, he realizes he is surrounded by some of the most dangerous-looking people he has ever encountered. There's the tattooed man who has turned his face and bald head into an art gallery, the muscle man bursting out of his suit, a dozen rings on his fingers, puffing at a cigar. A harpy sits next to him, clutching a cocktail with talon-like fingers, her black eyes challenging anyone to come near. Bodyguards are everywhere, all of them in cheap suits, watching over the men and women who employ them. Young hoodlums swagger and splash the cash. Geriatric bosses flag down the waiters and order ever more expensive drinks. The sheer extravagance of the Bohemia astonishes him. He did not know that Bollinger and Krug champagne were still available in London, yet bottle after bottle travels past him on silver trays. Some people are eating at their tables, and he sees and smells food that belongs to another age. Lobster, Dover sole, thick steaks, chips. Potatoes are plentiful. It's the oil that's in short supply. He can't imagine the prices. He has ordered a whiskey for himself and a lemonade for Holmes, and the cost almost wiped out all the money he had made from Edward Boyce, the one patient who consulted him. But nobody else is worried. He sees wallets so crammed with banknotes that the seams are close to tearing. And then there are the side chambers. John hadn't noticed them before, as they are deeply recessed and poorly lit. Deliberately so. The activities taking place here bring the blood rushing to his cheeks. Two women writhe on a sofa in one cubicle. In another, a group of friends take it in turns to lean over a mirror and hoover up white powder through a straw disappearing into their nostrils. A naked boy kneels with his head between a man's legs in a third. John has never thought of himself as a prude, but such displays, semi-public at best, leave him feeling disturbed. As the music continues, he becomes aware of a stirring in the room, a sense of a major event taking place. The conversation is muted. Heads are turning. John follows them. Perhaps the most beautiful woman he has ever seen has entered the space, trailed by two blank-faced bodyguards in obligatory dark glasses, white wires curling from behind their ears. She is dressed in a shimmering silver evening dress with a tie waist, holding a clutch bag. Her jet-black hair is tied back to reveal a diamond necklace and earrings that will have cost more than John will earn in a lifetime. He knows immediately that this is Irene Adler. It takes him a few moments longer to realize that she is coming towards them. A waiter produces a third chair and slides it against their table. Before he can react in any way, even getting to his feet would have been the polite thing to do, John sees the mistress of Bohemia sit opposite him. A second waiter is immediately at hand with a flute of champagne. Things return to normal in the club. The conversation rises, people look away. The music has never stopped. Holmes does not seem to have noticed her. His attention is fixed on the conjoined twins. "Mr. Holmes," she says. He turns and briefly acknowledges her. "I see you're taken by Yetta and Viviana," she continues. John loves the way she speaks, with a very slight Irish lilt to her voice. "The twins have been joined in that way for 27 years. And the sad thing is that from the moment they became aware of their situation, they have hated each other. Yetta once tried to murder Viviana. Or perhaps it was the other way round. She had to be told that were she to kill her sister, it would also be a death sentence for herself. And yet, don't they play beautifully together? I suppose it's one of life's paradoxes." Holmes has been listening to all this, but his eyes haven't moved from the stage. "You seem captivated," Irene says.
"I've never seen anything like it."
"Conjoined twins?"
"No. The instruments they're playing. What are they?"
Irene laughs. For a moment, her whole face is illuminated.
"You have never seen a violin before?"
"No." "Those are not just violins. They were made by Antonio Stradivarius in the 1680s. They are said to be the most perfect violins ever created. Everything about them, from the wood they are made of to the formula of the varnish, has been carefully designed to produce the sound you are hearing now. You notice the purity, the depth. It is magnificent."
"How could they afford them?"
John sighs. Even as he speaks, he regrets it. Irene Adler talks of beauty. His question has brought her plummeting back down to earth. "The violins belong to me," Irene replies. "I've allowed Yetta and Viviana to use them while they work for me. It enhances their music, and perhaps gives them one less thing to argue about." She turns her gaze back onto Holmes, examining him microscopically. There is something about him that seems to fascinate her. "I understand you wanted to speak to me," she says, at length.
"That's why we're here."
"Yes." She glances at his drink. "Not many of my customers order lemonade."
"The smell of alcohol upsets me."
"And why is that?"
"I have no idea."
"He's lost his memory," John says apologetically. "In fact, one of the reasons we came here is because..."
"I'd prefer to speak to your friend alone,"
Irene interrupts. But she does so in a way that somehow does not seem insulting.
While we talk, I would like to extend to you the hospitality of the club. I see that you have ordered our cheapest whiskey. Can I recommend one of the premium brands? The Balvenie 30-year-old single malt is particularly good. We have a few bottles left from 2029. You'll also have noticed that there are various other activities taking place here. They are not all to my taste, but I have to think of my clientele. If there is a young lady or gentleman who takes your fancy, you have only to ask. John is shocked, taken aback, and tempted all at the same time. The whiskey sounds like the best option, and with a nod at Holmes, who clearly has no problem with his disappearing, he heads for the bar. Irene Adler is left with Sherlock Holmes. "You took a great risk coming here tonight," she begins.
"I don't think so," Holmes replies.
"There are people looking for you."
"Moriarty?"
She frowns. "Who is Moriarty?"
"I have no idea. I know his name. Sometimes I hear it in my thoughts when I'm about to sleep. I think he's a danger to me. It's possible he works for Diogenes."
"I have never heard of Diogenes or Moriarty, but there are others." She sips her champagne. "Why did you say you were from the Red Circle?"
"It seemed like the easiest way to get in. In fact, I'm looking for them. You know who they are, I'm sure. Can you tell me where I might find them?"
"I'm afraid that's not possible."
"You know that they may have killed many hundreds of people. They've threatened a friend of mine. They're dangerous."
"That may be the case, Sherlock. You don't mind if I call you that. But if there is one rule at the Bohemia, it is that no confidences are ever broken. This is a safe space. Any conversations are completely private."
"Apart from those recorded by the camera and the microphone concealed in your clutch bag?"
She laughs a second time. "A lady has to look after herself, and that means total discretion. I tell one secret, I'm never trusted again."
"Then why have you joined me at this table?"
"Because you interest me, Sherlock. I meet a lot of very strange and exotic people, but they all have three things in common. They all want something from me. None of them can be trusted, and they bore me. None of this can be said about you."
"I came to the Bohemia asking for your help."
"And you have already accepted the fact that you're not going to get it. But you're still here."
The violins are still playing. Holmes examines the two women, at the same time listening keenly to the sound of the violins.
"What are the sticks made of?" he asks. "They are called bows, and they're made of horse hairs, I believe."
"I shall revise my opinion of horses."
"Have you ever been with a woman, Sherlock?" The question jolts him.
Irene has briefly found a way through his outer armor. "I don't even know what that means," he says. "Have you?"
"Oh, yes. Several of them." She smiles. "There's an innocence about you which many would find unappealing, but which is, for some reason, attractive. I'd like to see you again. Will you come back?"
"I think it unlikely."
"Suppose I break the rule of a lifetime and give you what you want."
"You will lead me to the Red Circle?"
"No. I've already told you. It would be the death of me. But I can introduce you to someone who may."
"And who is that?" She holds out her hand, and knowing instinctively what she wants, one of the bodyguards steps forwards and presses a mobile telephone into her hand. She turns her attention to the screen and quickly writes a text, her elegant fingers skipping rapidly over the keys. A pause of a few seconds, then the ping of a reply.
"His name is James Ryder," she replies. "He will meet you tomorrow at 6 o'clock at the old Paddington Cemetery, outside the East Lodge. He works for me, and he can be trusted to tell you what you need. But if you find what you are looking for, you must never forget. You are in my debt. And that's another of my rules. All debts must be repaid."
Holmes nods. Now it's his turn to examine Irene Adler, and she wonders what he's thinking. There are many men at the Bohemia who are attracted to her. Some of them have been brave enough to invite her out. But Sherlock Holmes gives nothing away. He seems to feel nothing.
Is he gay?
No. She doesn't think so. Eventually he speaks. I'm surprised you get a signal down here.
Disappointed, Irene Adler gets to her feet.
There are many things down here that will surprise you, Sherlock. She walks away.